Discuss today, or that we will read today. The second of the Kinot begins Eicha Atzdava Pecha, and the term Eicha, of course, is a key term, key motif in Tisha B'Av. Number of the Kinot begin with the word Eicha. I want to spend a little bit of time considering what does that word Eicha mean. The classic Mefarshim and the Midrashim say that Eicha is two words, Eicha. How could it be that this has happened? And Rav Soloveitchik explains that this term, Eikor, is really what he calls the matir of Tisha B'Av. It's what allows us to challenge HaKadosh Baruch Hu on Tisha B'Av. A lot of the kinot, the theme, is not just mourning, but it's asking the Almighty, how could it be that this thing has happened to the Jewish people? And he makes the observation that, generally speaking, we're not allowed to ask that question of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Mishnah in Masechet Brachot tells us, just as we praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what's good in our lives, we have to praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu in exactly the same way for what's bad in our lives. Unflinchingly, we have to praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So how can it be that on Tisha B'Av, we're allowed to challenge HaKadosh Baruch Hu and say, hold on, you know, this has gone too far. And he says that the kinot on Tisha B'Av are an exception to the rule. If we look on what I've copied out on page 5, he says, the case of kinot on Tisha B'Av, however, is an exception to the general rule. We are permitted to ask Eicha, because we're following the precedent of Yirmiyahu the Navi, who posed the question Eicha in the Book of Lamentations. And Jeremiah posed this question only because he was given a heter, special permission by God himself, who instructed him to write Eicha Yashva Vadad, the first sentence of the Book of Lamentations. In effect, God granted a unique privilege to Jeremiah to address himself to God with these otherwise impermissible questions and to write Kinot, Lamentations, in the form of book at the Book of Lamentations. The reason that God granted permission to express these otherwise inappropriate questions is that Jeremiah was expressing mourning for the destruction of the temple, and this tragedy was so overwhelming that the prophet and anyone else was granted unlimited freedom to pose questions that would have been inappropriate under any other circumstances. Thus, Rabbi Eliezer HaKalir is permitted to address the question Eicha to God, only because that question was already posed to God by Jeremiah in Lamentations. So we find that the term Eicha, according to Rav Soloveitchik, is a question of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How could he let this happen? And this is a unique question that we're able to ask on Tisha B'Av. We're not allowed to ask this this question on any other occasion. So as far as Rav Soloveitchik is concerned, it's a question. This is the way most of the classical Mefarshim understand it. Eikol. How could this have happened to the Jewish people? And, you know, you look at that first line of Megillat Eicha, Eicha Yashva Vadad Ha'ira Batiyam. How could something that was so splendid, so glorious, so bustling, have become so quiet, so empty, so bereft of people? That's the question. But I want to look at some other thoughts on this term Eicha and the first line of Megillat Eicha. There's just been published this year a book called Lamentations, Faith in a Turbulent World by Dr. Yael Ziegler, who's recently been appointed as the head of Matan Institute in Israel, and she's also part of Michlelet Herzog as well. We had Dr. Ziegler came to Alei Tzion a couple of years back as a scholar in residence, and she's an expert on Tanakh and understanding the Pshat in Tanakh, and she's just published a book with Koren this year on Megillat Eicha, which I think will be one of the very important works on Megillat Eicha in terms of understanding Pshat of Megillat Eicha, well worth getting hold of, and really thoughtful insights into what the Navi is trying to tell us. And I want to start off by looking at her observations on the word Eicha, And she makes the observation that Eicha has a dual meaning. The term Eicha means it's both a lament and also it's a rebuke. That's functioning as a rebuke as well as lament. The word Eicha may always contain elements of both. Isaiah laments Jerusalem's fallen state, even as he castigates her betrayal of God. This was the Haftarah that we read yesterday for Shabbat Chazon, and they're both elements of it. It's a Haftarah of mourning, but it's also a Haftarah of rebuke. And then she quotes a Medrash, where we have actually a machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah about the meaning of Eicha. Rabbi Yehuda said Eicha is a phrase of reproach, as it says, Eicha, how can you say we are wise and the Lord's instructions are with us? And Rabbi Nechemiah says it's a phrase of lament, quoting the Pasuk or misquoting the Pasuk in Parashat Bereshit of HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying to Adam HaRishon, Ayeka. Okay, Ayeka, that's where are you? But also being related or having the same letters as the word Eicha, and that was Rabbi Nechemiah says it's a lament, but she makes the observation that in actual fact it's much of a rebuke as a lament, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Adam HaRishon, and therefore it's both. And she says Rabbi Nechemiah is willing to sacrifice the simple meaning in order to communicate a crucial idea. His reading suggests that even when God reprimands, he's actually expressing a lament. God's love for his people and for Adam is so pervasive that all his rebukes are laced with sorrow. And this is something very, very special about HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship with Am Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't rebuke us without feeling pain at the fact that he has to rebuke us. We've got this notion of Imano Chivtzara, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu shares in our pain. And even when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who's imposing the pain on us, as it were, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's in pain about it himself, it's a lament that he has to do this. So Eicha is the book of Lamentations. It's also, I guess, a book of reproach. How could we have allowed this to happen to ourselves? So Eicha Yashva Vadad. How is it that this city is sitting, Badad is sitting alone? If you turn over to page 7, she makes some fascinating observations about this term, Badad, about this notion of Yerushalayim sitting alone. The top right-hand corner. That's Eicha opens with the quiet sounds of devastation, the eerie echoes of an emptied city. Loneliness dominates the opening chords of the book, illustrated poignantly by the metaphor of the widowed city, the Almana, and acknowledged explicitly by the use of the word Badad. Now she's going to teach us how the term Badad, how this Shoresh represents three different ideas, all of which are relevant to Tisha B'Av. Elsewhere in Tanakh, the word Badad describes a destroyed city, a social outcast, and a leper. The image of Yerushalayim sitting alone, Badad, evokes these usages, focusing attention on the pain of her desolation, the abandonment of her loved ones, and her pariah status within the world. The phrase Yashva Badad, also used about a leper, may allude to Jerusalem's culpability and sin, as noted by the Targum. So we see that this Eicha Yashva Badad, it's not just saying glibly, you know, look how Yerushalayim is sitting by itself. It's alone. What does that mean? It means that it's a sense of desolation, alone, not just being by yourself, but emptiness. There's nothing around you, or in the case of Yerushalayim, there was nothing in Yerushalayim. Secondly, the abandonment of her loved ones, this sense of Am Yisrael has gone into Galut and there's nobody left there. and also the fact that the nations of the world no longer had interest or confidence in the Jewish people and the Jewish homeland. And of course, this is something that we've seen repeatedly throughout the centuries, that the Jewish people and the Jewish state and Medinat Israel has had a pariah status. You know, if we look at just the recent conflict 2-3 months ago in Gaza and in cities in Israel and in Yerushalayim, you know, this notion of pariah status, you know, we might have won the battle in Gaza, but in terms of winning the battle in the arena of public opinion, we certainly didn't win that. And Israel, Medinat Israel, and by extension, Am Israel, the Jewish people, were accorded pariah status. And this is something which is true even today. While the word Badad primarily conveys the city's dreadful loneliness, however, now she says something again fascinating, a positive biblical usage of the word refers to Israel's singularity. Balaam prophetically proclaims that Israel is a people that dwells alone, Am Levadad Yishkon, and is not reckoned among the nations, emphasizing Israel's uniqueness. And this word may simultaneously point us to the cause of Israel's loneliness and to its solution. If only Israel had appreciated its singularity amongst the family of nations, Israel's desire to blend into the community of nations, her refusal to maintain her divinely mandated uniqueness, has turned a blessing of singularity, Am Levadad Yishkon, into a curse of isolation, Yashva Vadad. So this is very important notion, Yashva Vadad. We should be a people alone, but not alone in terms of humiliation, not alone in terms of a pariah status. We should be a people which is alone because of our uniqueness with the relationship that we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and also in terms of our uniqueness with regard to the morality that we display to the world, the Am Segula, the Ner Lagoyim, and all these sorts of things. And perhaps there's a notion that it's always going to be one or the other. So we can choose. We'll always be Am Levadad Yishkon. The question is, how do we want that bedidut, or how do we want that singularity to manifest itself? Do we want to manifest itself? We can choose for it to manifest itself as us being a unique and special nation. If we fail to choose that, then perhaps we are badad, we're left alone, we're a pariah nation. So I think that's food for thought. Food for thought there. Then Ha'ira Batiam Hayataka Almana. Why is Yerushalayim compared to the Almana? An Almana is a widow. And of course, the big problem with being compared to a widow is that widowhood never ends. A widow is somebody whose husband has passed away, and husband's passed away, he doesn't come back. Is this suggesting to us that Yerushalayim, there's no hope for Yerushalayim, nothing's ever going to be restored? So Dr. Ziegler quotes Rashi, of course, who points out that, of course, the word in the pasuk is Hayatak ke almana. It's like an almana. There's going to be a long period of separation, but ultimately things will be restored. It's not absolute widowhood. It's like widowhood. But let's see inside what our observations here are on the widowhood of Yerushalayim. The personification of Jerusalem coupled with her human-like actions, such as sitting alone, crying and mourning, arouses empathy. Her widowhood evokes physical and economic helplessness. The Bible often specifies the widow as one who deserves particular attention and care. Strikingly, the city remains unnamed for the first 3 verses of the chapter. Her anonymity mirrors her widowed state, suggesting that the loss of her husband signifies her loss of identity. This is something which often happens with people who experience a bereavement. Where it's a partner, sometimes a woman who's her identity has been tied up for so many years with the identity of her husband. When he passes away, her own raison d'etre for living and her own identity disappears as well. And that's perhaps what we're saying here with Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim loses its identity with the absence of the Beit HaMikdash. Without a Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, what is Yerushalayim? Is there any significant difference between Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv if the Beit HaMikdash isn't there? So I think there's a big difference between Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv, but that big difference is primarily because of the fact that the Beit HaMikdash was there. It's still the Makom HaMikdash. It's still got that Kedusha. If it didn't have that Kedusha, what difference would there be? So great, it had been once upon a time, the place of the Beit HaMikdash. If the Kedusha had disappeared, then Yerushalayim would be nothing. You may as well have the capital of Israel somewhere else. And perhaps the reason why so many countries have not recognized Yerushalayim as the capital of Medinat Yisrael maybe is something to do with the fact they don't recognize the sanctity of Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is the capital because of the sanctity. If you don't appreciate the sanctity, then you don't see why the capital needs to be in Yerushalayim. Alternatively, God can be identified as the deceased husband of Jerusalem, in this case representing the nation. After all, Israel's relationship with God is often described within a matrimonial context. So she then goes on to discuss the question, how can it be that God is deceased? And obviously that's a very big theological challenge. But if you turn the page to page 8, nevertheless, the meaning underlying the image of Jerusalem's widowhood remains problematic. Is it possible that Jerusalem's metaphoric husband, whether God or the nation, is like a deceased husband, never to return? Is Jerusalem's devastation hopelessly unalterable? The simile may reflect Jerusalem's state of mind in this chapter, her despair and her bleak outlook on the future. This is like other laments in this chapter. The Lord has placed me in the hands of those before whom I cannot rise. So this is what she's saying is that this simile of widowhood, Hayataka Almana, it's not widowhood in the sense that nothing's ever going to be restored, but it's the sense of loss that exists when widowhood hits. And I've seen this many occasions with widows, that their lives prior to their husband's death revolved around the husband. And then when the husband has gone, they're at a loss for what to do. And that is Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim revolved around the Beit HaMikdash, the spirituality. Once that's gone, what's left for Yerushalayim? Yeah, there's a city there, but so much is missing. So those are some thoughts of the thoughts on the meaning of the phrase Eicha, or the word Eicha, and the first pasuk of Megillat Eicha. We're now going to read the second of our kinot today on page 93 in the Rosenfeld, 217 in the Koren, 159 in the Art Scroll. And this is one of a number of what we will call compare and contrast kinot. We're comparing how the Jewish people have been berated and punished by HaKadosh Baruch Hu with the promises and the love that HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed us on previous occasions. And our response after each line is Zechor Hashem Mehayalanu, from that last the opening phrase of the last perek of Eicha. Hashem, remember what has happened to us. Hashem was so good to us. We had such a close relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu previously, and now that has been lost. 1, 2, 3, 4 lines in, four stanzas in, we have V'nosachatach Kitun Chukei Chorev. We talk about that, Chitun Chukei Chorev, the Chatunah, the marriage we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu because of what was given to us as Har Chorev, the Seret HaDivrot, which were inscribed. It's Torah Sivalanu Moshe, Morasha Kilat Yaakov. We don't read it as Morasha, but we read it as Mo'orasa. So we're reminding HaKadosh Baruch Hu, now we're like a widow. Once upon a time, we were married to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, think back to that relationship that we had, and please try and restore it for us. Gideon will read the next kinah.